Hey, this is Peter Mills. I'm the author of The Monkey's Head and the Sixties, and you're listening to Mr. Media.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MrMedia.com. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, iTunes, Apple News, Google Play, or Stitcher, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On today's show, I'll welcome writer Peter Mills. His new book is The Monkeys, Head, and the 60s. Stick around. There are some truly horrific movies in the history of cinema. I didn't realize until yesterday that one of them starred the Monkeys: Davy Jones, Mickey Dolenz, Peter Tork, and Mike Nesmith. Head, a 1968 theatrical release starring the prefab foursome, represents 85 minutes of my life that I will never get back again. Now, what astonishes me is that anyone, not even Jack Nicholson, one of the writers responsible for this legendary atrocity, could make the super charismatic band at all uninteresting. I avoided watching Head for almost 50 years, but finally broke down and watched it for free, fortunately, on YouTube, so I can't complain about spending the money, because I wanted to understand what drove British journalist Peter Mills to write an entire book about the band and the movie. In The Monkeys, Head and the 60s, Mills dissects the band, the film, and its soundtrack, adding deep cuts of history to the misbegotten cinematic dud. I am old enough to have watched and adored The Monkees in its original 1966-68 run on NBC. I still have my original Monkees albums, even the one my baby brother took a bite out of, and I'm going to show you this because nobody ever believes me. So if you're watching the video, check this out. See that? Can you see that, Peter?
I can see it. That's a hefty bite.
I'll put my hand behind it just so we're clear. Yes. Yeah. He was my baby brother. It's just something he did, but I still have it. It's the original. I bought it at a little drugstore, which is where we used to have to buy records. So, I mean, you know, I even interviewed Mickey Dolenz back in the 80s, I think about 1984, for the St. Petersburg Times. That was a big highlight for me. So, but I got to say, folks, after this interview, as wonderful a guy as I'm sure Peter Mills is, I'm going to try to focus my memories on the TV series and forget I ever saw Head. And with that bizarre intro, Peter Mills, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Well, I can see I'm going to have to mount a sterling defense of the film here, aren't I?
What? Yeah. I got to ask, why break down a little scene, 50-year-old movie that was not particularly admired? It never broke out at the box office in its original run. It hasn't had much of a second life. So my biggest question is, what drew you to this? I'm fascinated by this part of it.
Well, initially, it was the same way that sort of any young person gets interested in the work of a band who have broken up and dispersed. I mean, pre-Google, it was kind of a bit hit and miss, you know, finding the material, finding albums you didn't know existed that you hadn't heard of. And I was looking for Monkees records because I discovered the Monkees through the TV show on the repeats on the BBC in the mid-1970s, it was. And one of the albums that I found was the soundtrack album to Head. And it's I'm sure if people have seen it, they'll remember the cover. The American, the US cover, was kind of mylar. It was kind of shiny stuff that you get on, you know, like on kids' helium balloons, you know, that kind of super shiny stuff. But the rest of the world just got a plain white sleeve. So the English copy that I found just had this plain white sleeve. I was thinking, what's this? Well, a very un-monkey-like cover. And then on the back, there's a picture of the band, and it says, you know, music from the Columbia Pictures movie Head, starring the Monkees. So that piqued my interest straight away. So, you know, I'd already seen Hard Day's Night and Help, Yellow Submarine. So I thought, well, where can I see this thing? Little did I know it would be about another 15 years before I was able to actually track down a copy on videotape. So I had a kind of long run up to seeing it. So I was kind of very interested in the Monkees then as now, actually a bit of a lifelong obsession. I was going to say interest, but obsession's probably more accurate and more truthful. So I was very keen to see it, and the album I would say, I don't know if you know the album, Bob, the soundtrack album. Ah, well, you got to check that out, man.
I don't think
because,
so.
Because, oh, no. All right, I'm going to sell it to you, okay, in 20 seconds. It stands as a work of art on its own. It only lasts about 35 minutes, and it's extraordinary sort of mixture of the songs from the film, collage of dialogue, little snippets of dialogue, very modern sounding, actually. Mm. And it was assembled by Jack Nicholson. He actually put that album together. So I'm, as I do in the book, I make a strong argument that that's a kind of a work of art in itself. But the movie, my sort of academic interest in the movie, because I teach at a university over here in England, and one of the modules is called Popular Music and the Moving Image. That's that kind of, so it's like a history of pop on TV, pop in the movies, music video, pop through new media, live performance, etc., etc. And of course, the Monkees kind of fit squarely into certainly the pop on TV bit. And by this time, I'd acquired a copy of Head on video cassette initially, and then the various DVD reissues. I mean, you say it hasn't had much of a second life, but it has become, you know, your actual cult movie now. Peter Tork famously said that in its initial iteration, you're absolutely right, Bob, it died a death that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. That was the phrase, right, that he used. I mean, he's not exaggerating either. I mean, it really was sort of box office poison. But very, very slowly, initially through the developing reputation of Bob Rafelson as a, you know, sort of a director, part of the American New Wave, and then gradually as the Monkees' work has gradually been thought about differently, because they were kind of dismissed a bit, weren't they, at the time? Sure. If you weren't of an age, they were kind of said, oh, it's just kid stuff. But as time has gone by, maybe partly because, you know, the original audience has just got older, and then they get into positions of cultural authority. I don't know whether that's it. But the work's been reappraised, and, well, they're still going, aren't they? Just celebrated the 50th anniversary. So they must be doing something right.
Yes, but I don't think any of it has anything to do with Head.
Well, I don't know about that. It's certainly part, I think it's part of the appeal. I think the range of the output, you know, if you compare it with like the early albums that you were talking about, and you know, your Auntie Griselda, and you know, all those kind of things, which, you know, it's kids pop music, really. I mean, right, it's wonderful, but it's kids music. And then just a couple of years later, after the kind of the little palace revolution that they had, where they took over their own affairs and made that album, Headquarters, that your little brother loved so much he wanted to bite. So, I mean, what an endorsement that is. And then, you know, they kind of, the sales were sort of went down, but the quality of the music kind of rose in a way. And by the time they made Head, the TV series had been cancelled, and they were clearly not, you know, the teeny group that they'd been, or the teen-friendly group that they'd been 2 years ago. They're more interested in making a kind of countercultural statement on a Hollywood budget, which is what Head is, really.
Well, but
for all its faults.
But that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, the Monkees succeeded all those, well, the couple of years that they were a big thing. Mm-hmm. Based on the charisma of these four young men, it was. Yeah. I mean, I think if Stephen Stills had wound up in the band, as we know, mm-hmm. he was the original for the Peter Tork role.
That's right.
It might not have worked the same way, but there's something about these four guys. They had they saw themselves as they could make fun of themselves. They could make fun of each other. The music was good, whether it was initially it was Boyce and Hart or it was Neil Diamond, or, you know, whoever it was.
Carol King and Jerry Goffin,
right?
Yeah,
but they took apart what they were in this movie. It was almost like I wanted to ask you, do you think Jack Nicholson just hated the idea of the Monkees and the commercialization of pop? It just seemed like he went in writing the script, and Bob Rafelson's part, it seems like they wanted to destroy what they had rather than, I mean, today we would look at it and go, if you wanted to make a protest film with something like this, you would still make it funny. You would still give it the elements of what it had, and then you would go kind of guerrilla with it at the same time. But you would still look for, you would still look for songs that were good quality songs that, you know, fit. You would, but I mean, we have the that horrible image of the child or the man being shot in Vietnam,
and, yeah,
and all the war stuff, and it just it didn't work. I mean, it just didn't work. And you took these four very charismatic fellows who were at different times in the movie. They show glimpses of that, even when they're saying, even when they're acknowledging that they're prefab pop and that they're an invention or that they're this or that, you know, what you see is not what you get. Fine, you know, but it just wasn't funny and it wasn't particularly clever. It didn't. It just didn't seem to work.
Well, oh no, where to begin? well, it's absolutely true that they colluded in the destruction of their own public image. I mean, it's no accident the film begins and ends with them jumping off the Gerald Douglas Bridge at Long Beach. You know, I mean, one of the several working titles of the movie was "The Monkeys Commit Suicide." It's so that idea of just kind of taking apart their public image was central to it. But the Monkees were the experience of being in the Monkees and the whole, if you look at the story of the Monkees over those 3 years really that they were going, that they had any commercial traction, although they carried on for a little bit longer into early 1970. They were kind of born out of extremity. Everything was extreme. Everything was full on. Going from, you know, Peter Tork washing pots in, you know, in a diner, and Bob Rafelson going to find him because Stephen Stills, as you rightly say, said, well, if you don't want me, go and get this friend of mine who kind of looks a bit like me and he's a bit funnier than I am. Maybe he's who you're after. So to go from pot washing to being, you know, part of the most successful pop project on the planet in about 6 months, you know, that's extreme. And then the global success through the television, and then the strange transformation into a quote unquote real band through public demand, you know, having to go out and do concerts and stuff. And then having to fight, having to sort of assert themselves into existence with Headquarters and Pisces Aquarius, and a couple of albums that followed that. So I think that the extremity, which you rightly identify in the movie, and it's continual. It's a kind of an assault on the senses in a way. I mean, if we've got time, I'll come back to that. But I would say that's kind of born out of what it was like to be around the Monkees, to be in the Monkees, or to be around the Monkees. Everything happened fast. Everything happened, you know, absolutely at jet speed. Mm. And, you know, if you weren't looking, you'd miss it. I mean, head's like that, isn't it? If you're not looking, you'll miss it. Sometimes that's all right because something's horrible or something's boring. And it's all right because in a minute there'll be another scene. But, you know, the speed of it and the sort of the visual non sequiturs between the scenes, I think, anyway, is kind of deliberate. It's sort of a composite to show what it was like to be around the success of a project like the Monkees. I think so, anyway. But, you know, I know, unlike the awful Vietnam footage that crops up three, maybe even four or five times in the movie, we shouldn't forget they could have been those images could have been taken from that evening's news. So, you know, it was a kind of collision of showbiz and reality.
Oh, I wasn't turned off by the imagery being part of the error. I was turned off because it just didn't seem to fit anything else that was going on. So let me ask you this. You in the book, and the book is extremely well written. I don't want to take anything away from the book.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I read the book and it I'm a Monkees fan. I wanted to know, you know, but you spent about 100 pages in the book breaking down the script for Head.
Mm.
I should tell people, you take time at the beginning and you talk about the era of the 60s. You introduce us to each of the monkeys. You tell us a bit about their backstory. There's things that I've read, you know, that I had not read before about the monkeys, and I like to think that I know that whole story pretty well.
Great.
But yeah, it's very, very interesting, very well told. And you break down the script and the film itself over about 100 pages, which is, you know, there's chapter, 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 and then 100 pages on the movie, and then chapter, chapter. So what I'm curious is, how many times did you have to watch the movie to do that? And did your opinion of the film, did it get better with repeated viewing? Did you, you know, are you, I don't know, what, you know, what kept driving you to keep looking at it?
Sure. Well, I mean, in the wider sense, the reason that I wrote the book was because I kept waiting for somebody to write a book about the monkeys that addressed Head. Hmm. Because there are some wonderful books out about the monkeys, chronological ones, fan ones, books by Davy and Mickey themselves. But they all seem to sort of skirt round Head, really. Not because people wanted to pretend it didn't exist, or because they were embarrassed by its failure, but because it's like the old riddle wrapped in an enigma inside a mystery sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's something to take on, a film like that. So the fact that nobody had done it, and the fact that I had this sort of frankly unusual level of interest in it made me think, well, you know, I'm going to have to do this thing. So, you know, I got the commission from Jawbone Books, New York and London, and got the green light. Up to that point, I'd shown Head to my students every year for maybe 10 years, I think. How long have I been there now? Probably about 10 years. And I'd seen it maybe half a dozen times before that. So even before I started writing the book, I must have seen the film about 25 times. Yeah. So this is what I'm recommending to you, Bob, right? Don't go on one time, son.
Not going to happen.
2 dozen times to go, then we can have a conversation.
Not going to happen. Listen, I'll tell you, you don't know. I mean, I studied film. That's my degree is in film.
Okay.
I love film. I you know, I would go to, when I was growing up, there was a 99-cent theater in New Jersey where I would go. I would ride my bicycle. It was about a 10-mile in each direction ride.
Wow.
I would ride my bicycle there, and they had multiple films during the course of a day, something the theaters don't do anymore, at least here. And I would sit and I would watch whatever they put up. 99 cents to see this horrible Monty Python-esque film, Jabberwocky.
Ninety-nine cents
to see, you know, like the last film that Orson Welles did. I mean, whatever it was, just horrible, horrible movies. I mean, I understand the fascination with dissecting a bad movie or an ill thought of movie like Plan 9 from Outer Space, the Ed Wood film, or, you know, there's a lot of them out there. I was really hoping, because I read the book first and then watched the movie, and I was thinking,
okay,
wow, I want to see this movie now. But then I watched it and I went, no, I really wish I could erase that from my memory banks. It just, I love those guys. I mean, and what's interesting is, folks, if you see it, you can watch the whole movie for free, at least at the moment, on YouTube. And the way it works on YouTube now, depending on how your browser is set up, it will play that, and then to the right, it'll show you related shorts and videos that you can see. I saw a whole bunch of documentaries, including a 30-minute documentary with Bob Rafelson on Head.
Yeah.
Which I actually found more interesting than the movie itself, you know, as he talked about it and you got his perspective. Yeah. And then there were a lot of interviews with monkeys and a lot of stuff that I had just never unearthed before. But I just couldn't – I just didn't buy the movie as – despite all of your wonderful writing and research. The research is fascinating. Everything I learned about them – I was fascinated with. I'm always fascinated with, but
great.
I just didn't buy me. Oh, and by the way, listen, for people who are watching this on video, there's the monkeys' headquarters. There's the monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
There's more of the monkeys. There's the birds and the bees and the monkeys. Oh, there's my Partridge Family album. Look, we've even got the banana splits.
Fantastic!
Everything's Archie. and Then and Now, The Best of the Monkeys. I think this is when I interviewed Mickey a few years ago. So, okay. I mean, I'm that guy. I'm that guy of a certain middle age who, you know, really, really is fond of the band. Let's change gears a little bit. Let's talk about Jack Nicholson. I mean, I'm sure people are very surprised when they find out that Nicholson there's a little walk-on part where we actually see him.
Yeah, he and Dennis Hopper just appear just for a moment.
Right. Yeah. How weird is it that Jack Nicholson was in this? And how did this affect his career, do you think, at that point?
Well, I guess he probably thought it was just kind of a smallish thing at the time, because Nicholson was, you know, he was on the scene. He'd slightly worn a rut in kind of sort of schlocky movies that he'd been doing. And he had a bit of form in the psychedelic field as well, of course, through The Trip and Psych Out, which came out the same year as Head. In fact, if people know the film, and you no doubt recall, Bob, from seeing it recently, the Timothy Leary character, this sort of monstrous figure who struts about the set and pops up periodically and sort of terrifies everybody, that was... That was originally written for Bruce Dern, because he was friends with Nicholson, and they both appeared in Psych Out. But Nicholson was friend with Rafelson, and Rafelson clearly thought that Nicholson could do the job script-wise, that, you know, he had that kind of mixture of sort of sly countercultural element to it, but also had enough of the iconoclastic element in him to do the job that Rafelson wanted the movie to do, really, as far as the brand of the Monkees went. And of course, Easy Rider was financed actually by Monkees money. Mm. I mean, it came through Rafelson, and although Dennis Hopper directed it, obviously. So in a way, you can say that the Monkees and Head kind of kickstarted the American New Wave, in terms of, you know, the kind of the early 70s sort of reinvention of American cinema. So that's how Nicholson kind of got on board, really, because he was kind of in the right place at the right time, but he was also the right stuff for the project.
Well, and people who write off the Monkees as being just, you know, claptrap miss and think that there was just this TV invention. Okay, there's Nicholson was involved in the movie. We know that Mickey spent time, got to know Lennon and McCartney, was treated very respectfully by them. Peter Tork, friendly with Stephen Stills. I imagine they're still friends. You know, I don't know how close they are, but at the time, I mean, Stills got him the gig. These four guys, they had reputations of their own. They were well thought of. Whatever was going on there with the music and doing a TV sitcom. Yeah, it's interesting. I wish that they had done something just a little bit different. There's so much. I mean, the people in the 60s didn't enjoy this movie that was very 60s. Different generations do grab hold of different pop culture.
Yes.
You mentioned before that you show this in a class that you teach every year. I'm curious, what is the name of the class, and what other films do you show in the class?
Well, the name of the class is it's a course, Popular Music and the Moving Image, and usually I only show Head, not because there aren't 50 other films I could show them, but by and large it's hard enough to get them to come and pay attention to a single film rather than a whole season of them. But in the past I've shown things like Performance and This Is Spinal Tap and Stop Making Sense.
Was that Mick Jagger?
I beg your pardon. Yeah, Performance. I meant Privilege, actually.
Oh,
the Peter Watkins thing. Oh, with Paul Jones. It's kind of a like dystopian thing. Very, very British.
Yeah.
Very British mid-60s. But Paul Jones, just after he left Manfred Mann, plays the lead. It's a great film. I think maybe you'd enjoy it.
I will make a note of that. I will look for that.
Yeah.
I will not watch Head again, but I will look for that.
No, okay. All right, it's the deal.
See, I have an open mind.
No, I don't doubt you for one second.
Yeah, I know.
No, it's very difficult. I mean, it's when I show it to the students, usually it's about 80% people of the students come out thinking, well, what was that? And two or three will say, that was amazing. Where can I find out more about it? And two or three either leave halfway through because they can't stand it, or they're in tears, or something, you know. So, and I think all three kind, you know, the full range of response is entirely appropriate, because it's an unusual film. It's unusual in its content, you know, the episodic content, which is not unlike the TV show in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, 1 minute they'll be doing one thing, and then, as if by magic, something else is happening. So there's that kind of counterintuitive narrative thing going on. So you'll get those kind of juxtapositions. And there's some sort of little, very interesting little cultural moments in there. Perhaps you remember the bit where there's a bit of channel surfing going on.
Yeah.
And do you remember? And it turns out it's Victor Mature's hand.
Oh, my God, that's so clicking. It's so bizarre.
And those juxtapositions, you know, it's an advert, it's a scene from Vietnam, it's a cartoon, it's a secondhand car salesman, it's Walter Cronkite. It's a, you know, those kind of juxtapositions are kind of interesting, and they're very novel for the time, I think.
There is a, I don't know if you call it a walk-on, there's a scene where they're on a Hollywood backlot late in the movie where there's a lot of stuff going on, and there is a woman in a Dream of Jeannie harem costume. But it's not Barbara Eden, but it was clearly Barbara Eden's costume, and I just wondered, if did I miss something in the book about that, or did you know anything about that? I thought that was rather interesting.
No, well, you have just proved a point about head, Bob, that it doesn't matter how many pages you spend on it, you always miss something. So there you go. Didn't miss anything. I just didn't write about it.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to confess to that one.
All right. See, but I did pay attention both in the in the book and the movie. That was surprising. I mean, they were both The Monkees and I Dream of Jeannie were both NBC shows.
Yeah.
And you know, there were other things that were, but I thought, well, that's odd. Why somebody dressed as Barbara Eden's character?
I mean, the Monkees did kind of supersede I Dream of Jeannie. Mm. So there might have been some comment about that, you know, in the slot. It took over I Dream of Jeannie's slot.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So maybe that's maybe there was some reference there, or maybe they just fancied using it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So do your kids, I'm sorry, you know, we're both of a certain age, the students in your classes, and by the way, I looked, you teach at Leeds Beckett University, correct?
That's right, yes.
All right. So if anyone's watching and is curious to, you know, look into the course, I just want them to know where it's being taught. Do they actually know who the Monkees are, or are they coming to it kind of, you know, raw in terms of, okay, this is we're going to watch a film and something called the Monkees, but I mean, it's been 50 years. Kids can be excused if they don't know who the Monkees are at this point.
No, absolutely right. And usually they don't. I mean, in every year, there are maybe one or two kids who are already experts. Mm. So, like, for example, two or three weeks ago, I just happened to mention television, the you know, Marquee Moon Adventure, that group, the American group. And I was saying, oh, probably the best group to come out of the New York sort of so-called punk scene. And this kind of 18-year-old kid comes up to me afterwards and says, no, I disagree. I think the Modern Lovers were better. So, you know, every year there'll be one of those. And you think, where have you got this information from? It's fantastic. And likewise, there's usually a couple of them who at least recognize the Monkees. Mm. Or if you give them a little bit of a nudge, I'm a Believer, Last Train to Clarksville, you know, the famous ones. So, oh, yes, I've heard those. Or, you know, my parents have got those. So this kind of thing. Mm. But they're always very open to it. And what they also understand is that there was a process which kind of was brought into being with the Monkees and proved itself to be successful, which is kind of ongoing. You know, the idea of casting for success, how an act can be kind of put together to meet a market demand. And they understand that very well because, of course, it, you know, it's still happening with things like American Idol and X Factor in this country. So that process, they're absolutely familiar with that. And they have less of a problem with that than perhaps people did, you know, 50 years ago. Because their idea of what, you know, the authentic in music is different. You know, to them, do I like it or not is the question. Not, well, have they paid their dues or not?
Right.
Yeah, so there's they do come at it slightly differently in that way. Yeah. But, you know, I guess they get browbeaten by my enthusiastic advocacy. And so, and then they take it on board. And they're very bright kids and they're very interested in the history of popular culture. And I think that the Monkees are very, very important to the history of popular culture.
And
music, film, TV.
On this, we completely agree.
Yeah.
No argument from me about that. So Peter, what's next for you? Are you going to tackle, are you going to do another book with another, you're going to slice up another piece of pop culture? Something different?
Well, there's a couple of things really, Bob. I should say this actually, and then the world can breathe a sigh of relief. The original manuscript of this book was nearly twice as long as the one that got published.
Yeah,
I think
you mentioned that in the introduction, don't you?
Probably.
Yeah. I thought, so we wow. Had to lose a lot,
so.
Yeah. Wow.
We thought 100 pages, that was the edited version.
God.
So maybe if anybody's interested, I might sort of do something with that, because there was a lot more on the music, actually. Most of the movie stuff went in, but there was a lot more about the music, which you know, I had to set aside for reasons of space. So I might do something with that if people are interested.
Sounds like a blog to me.
You think?
Oh, absolutely. Sounds like a wonderful blog that would just, complement the book.
That is a brilliant idea, actually. Yeah. I'm going to write that down.
Please.
That's a great idea.
Hopefully that'll make up for my being kind of dubious about the movie.
Well, no, it's fantastic. I mean, it's entirely, you know, it's the correct response, really. You know, I mean, I don't know how anybody could watch that film once and, you know, get it or think, oh, that was the greatest movie I've ever seen or anything like that. You know, it's like Finnegan's Wake or something. You know, you're going to go back into it and back into it and back right. into it, and slowly it reveals itself.
I have to admit, I did like the vacuum cleaner scene. I don't know why. But that was because it seemed like something that would come out of the TV series.
Absolutely.
It worked. Not working on another book at the moment?
Well, if I don't do the Monkees thing, it's a slight difference. Somebody's asked me to do a book on popular music and the Cold War, the role of popular music in during the Cold War.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, so that's another kind of little interest of mine. So that's a possibility.
Cool. Well, folks, listen, you can find Peter Mills' new book, The Monkees, Head, and the 60s, at great bookstores anywhere, or you can order it right here at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching on MrMedia.com, and I know you could be seeing it on iTunes or Stitcher or anywhere else, but if you're watching the video on MrMedia.com, just below the video itself, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it, you can order the ebook version, have it instantly downloaded to your e-reader, or you can have the paperback version sent to you within a day or two. Or if you're within Amazon, maybe you can get it 30 minutes by drone. I don't know. You know, by the time you get this, who knows what's possible. Peter, do you have a website? Are you in social media? Can people find you anywhere?
They can find me on Twitter, PEM33RPM. That's how it goes.
All right, very good.
But that's it. I'm not much of a social media gadfly, but I am on Twitter, so it's PEM33RPM.
Excellent. Well, I got to say, I enjoyed reading the book. It's absolutely fascinating reading, and I know that other people will and do enjoy the movie itself. I'm just expressing the opinion of one man, but. Peter,
fantastic.
I am delighted to talk to you. I hope that if you do another book, you'll come back. And
I'd love to.
Thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks very much, Bob.
I'm not going outside. to believe her. A bad idea to believe her. Turn up the stereo receiver. Turn up the stereo receiver.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of teeny boppers daydreaming of meeting Davy Jones in the next life in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Poor Davy.
Poor Davy.
Poor Davy.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Rich Scheidner. If you've ever wondered what it was like to be a stand-up comedian in the 1980s, I'm going to do you a big favor. Instead of billions of dollars for a time machine, you can just spend $24.95 and buy my new book, Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. It will save you money and give you thrills. It will take you there. Go to my website, richscheidner.com. Go to amazon.com and buy this book.